Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country. We love against enemies, all of both foreign and domestic, and doing so, we hope, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to focus in the first instance on a problem set that seems to be advancing at the moment in ways that are very, very ominous indeed. And sadly, we talk about that sort of thing here most of the time, and I wish it were the case that there's more good news than bad, but we operate on the conviction that you need to know the news, whether it's good or bad, because it ultimately will affect, well, not just the country we love, as I say, but also personally your own future as well. A woman we turn to talk about particularly trouble on the horizon in the Middle East is our friend Shoshana Bryan. She is these days the director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center, long experienced in Washington and very, very knowledgeable about the Middle East, and just an, I think, indispensably important figure in sorting out the noise from the signal, as they say, and we hope presenting what you need to know about what is developing with our friends in Israel, as well as elsewhere in the region, that could be, well, quite portentous for all of us. Shoshana Bryan, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
All the reports that I'm seeing, Shoshana, suggest that enemies of Israel, who I think are without exception our enemies as well, are sensing from the turmoil that's been taking place in Israel over judicial reform and demonstrations and people in uniform saying they're not going to turn up if called up, as well as the policies of the Biden administration towards Israel, towards the region more generally. And I'm thinking particularly of Iran. And if we're talking about Iran, we're talking about Hezbollah, we're talking about Hamas, we're talking about Palestinian Islamic Jihad and others. All of them seem emboldened at the moment to think that this may be a moment to act violently against Israel yet again. Give us your reading on sort of the lay of the land, if you would, and then we'll talk about what that all means for us.
Well, the lay of the land is shaky. It's never a good idea to show your enemies that you have concerns, that you have issues, that you may not be a united front where they are concerned. It's one thing to talk about reforming the judiciary or even the building of communities in the West Bank. It's another to say, my military may not be what I want it to be. And there you have to differentiate between two things, and I'll get to them later. But for the moment, places like Iran, which surrounds Israel in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in the Gaza Strip, and increasingly is making inroads into Jordan and the West Bank. The raid on Jenin last month by the Israel Defense Forces was really about pulling out Iranian-supported militias. So they're getting much more comfortable with the idea that they control all of the territory that surrounds Israel. Then you add to that, and here's where the United States comes in, did two things, not just one, but two. First of all, belittling or denigrating Israel and its democracy can never be helpful, never, ever. Inserting the United States into the internal affairs of another country can never be helpful. The most unhelpful thing is to provide tons and tons of money to Israel's enemies. $6 billion is a lot of dollars. Yes, I realize we're getting back five Americans. I'm pleased by that. $6 billion.
It puts a price on the head of every American, it seems to me, and a very steep price at that. But to your point, the $6 billion in frozen assets that we've agreed effectively to pay as ransom for these five Americans is going to be, based on hard experience with the Iranians, put not into improving the lot in life of their people or otherwise you know, constructive activities, but into things like threats to their neighbors, threats to Israel, most especially threats to us, whether they're nuclear, whether they're terrorist of other stripes. This is a misbegotten policy of the first order, and unfortunately, we've seen this play before. It does not end well, does it? So where does that leave Israel at the moment? Do you assess that they are now facing a palpably greater danger than they have for some time? Shoshana Bryan.
The danger's always been ratcheting up, and it continues to ratchet up. And at some point, you hit the red line. Yes. Iran poses a greater threat to Israel now than it did before because its proxies are better armed and they're feeling a little bit cocky. And the Iranians are getting closer and closer to nuclear capability. Money helps.
Yeah. You mentioned the last time you were on, I think, and it was roughly the time that the president of Israel was addressing a joint session of Congress, that he made a point to a standing ovation, as I recall, that Israel would not tolerate Iran being a so-called threshold nation, something that the incumbent chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, had said the United States was actually okay with. Define the term for us, if you would, Shoshana, and if Israel is not okay with that status, we're over the red line, aren't we?
So the status has to do with how fast you can actually create and deliver a bomb. Iran has been enriching uranium forever and a half. It got within a 2.5% of weapons grade. It's got to 87.5%. Apparently it's backed off just a tiny bit right now, but the back off can be reversed any day. So they're right up at the edge. One thing that is a matter of consensus in Israel, nothing is really a matter of consensus in Israel, but this is: Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And the question will be, what can they do about it? Here, there's even a little bit of good news. The United States military and the Israeli military have become much, much closer together in the last 15 or 16 months. The ascent of General Michael Eric Kirilla, to commander of CENTCOM has made a big difference for both countries. Cross your fingers.
Well, let's tease that out a little bit. First of all, you have the question of whether, I mean, when people say, you know, they're within 2% or they've backed off from it, this assumes a level of insight into a program that is very secretive. The Israelis have penetrated it, that's for sure, including absconding with incredible quantities of classified information from deep inside that nuclear program of Iran's. But still, are you confident that we have the kind of precision that we can say, well, they've enriched it to just shy of the weapons grade level, and that for that matter, what they've got isn't actually sufficiently enriched for weapons purposes? Point one, and point two, Shoshana, that if they've got a lot of secret activities, that we know that they haven't put what they've got into actual weapons as well. Very quickly.
There's always been a theory that Iran already has a bomb. It might. But yes, I think the Israelis are very good at what they're doing, which is understanding what the Iranians are doing.
Well, hold the thought. We're going to come back to that particular point and what all this might mean for Israel's course of action in the near future, and whether that CENTCOM commander is going to ensure that we're on the right side when it goes down. Stay tuned for that and more with Shoshana Bryan right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. You don't have to embrace conspiracy theories about how a lot of Maui just burned up to feel uneasy about plans the state government of Hawaii had for the island before the fire. A Hawaii Digital Government Summit, scheduled for next month in Maui, suggests Governor Josh Green and his subordinates envision it becoming a smart island. The word smart these days actually means control. Smart meters, smart appliances, smart cities, and most especially, smart medical cards, vaccine passports, and other IDs are means of turning over data and ultimately decisions about your life to somebody else. Inevitably, that will mean the government. If fundamentally transforming a tropical paradise into a digital gulag repels you, brace for what the smart people behind giving the World Health Organization dictatorial powers have in mind for all of us. Learn more at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're visiting with Shoshona Bryan, one of the most serious, knowledgeable, and I think insightful experts we focus on the Middle East with. And we do so from her vantage point as the policy director of the Jewish Policy Center. And Shoshona, you have laid out, I think, as we described at the beginning, the lay of the land very nicely. Israel is now more or less surrounded by entities that are not just hostile to it, but that are being supported by its mortal enemy, Iran, a nation that has, from the inception of the current regime, made very clear death to Israel was one of its mantras and guiding purposes. As, by the way, was death to America, of course. What we've seen them doing in Iran, in addition to now encircling the Jewish state and building up the capabilities of terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, for example, with some estimates are an unbelievable 100,000+ missiles and rockets capable of ranging the entire country, increasingly with very high accuracy as well, and possibly chemical weapons, who knows what all else. But in addition to all of that, the Iranians are, as we were discussing earlier, very, very, very close, if not actually across the line, to having nuclear weapons that, as you say, the government of Israel, the people of Israel, have said repeatedly they're not going to allow them to get. So, by the way, has our government, under successive administrations of both parties. That does seem now to be imminent, though. And the question, I guess, to you as a serious student of these matters is, does Israel have real options at this point to try to preclude that from happening?
There are options. Not all of them involve a large airplane dropping a large bomb on a nuclear facility. There are lots of other options. Stuxnet was one, if you remember, back in the Obama administration. It worked very well until President Obama decided to let the Germans fix the computers. But there are all kinds of other things. You can cripple Iran by taking out its ports. You can take out its IRGC, take out its headquarters, take out the Pasiji Guard. There are lots of things you can do. But one of the things that should concern us is that Iran may be dangling this nuclear thing in front of us in order to keep people from dealing with the conventional threats. And the conventional threats are not only to Israel, but Iran wants to control Mecca and Medina. That's the threat to Saudi Arabia. And it wants to control Al-Azhar University in Cairo. That's a threat to Sunni Egypt. So it's a broader threat. It's also a conventional threat. And we've spent way too long missing the conventional part of this. And that's coming home to roost next.
Yeah. And when you say conventional threat, that you're really talking about not just conventional military. You're talking about, you know, subversion. You're talking about influence operations, penetration, and so on. Shoshona, you know this subject intimately. We're always told that the Sunnis and the Shia are unalterably opposed to one another. The idea that the Sunnis would somehow allow Shia to take the most holy sites in all of Islam, in Saudi Arabia, Mecca, Medina, or for that matter, the Vatican, as it's called by some of Islamic faith in Al-Azhar University in Cairo, seems to be pretty much of a stretch. I can certainly see the argument being made that the Iranians are amassing military capabilities to afflict those places if they choose to do so. And for that matter, Shoshana, they're putting into place, I believe, in our own hemisphere, the means to afflict this country as well, bring death to America as well from within reach of our shores. But explain what your thought is there in terms of the threats to Mecca, Medina, and Al-Azhar.
Okay, first of all, I would point out Sunnis and Shia got along perfectly nicely for many, 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 many years. The biggest rift came when the mullahs took over Iran and announced that Shias would from here on out be superior and supreme. So there's lots of ways to look at that history. You're right. The Sunnis are not going to roll over and let them have Mecca and Medina. This is where the Abraham Accords came from. This was the realization by Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, which isn't quite it's still on the fence. It hasn't quite leaked yet, that they need more help in dealing with the threat of Iran, all of the threats of Iran. It accounts for why Israel and Egypt have a much better relationship, security relationship, now than they used to. Al-Sisi in Egypt is not going to let the Iranians take Al-Azhar without a fight, a big fight. But remember, that's out there.
But when you say take it, do you mean physically seizing these places through conventional action of some kind?
Two different things. Mecca and Medina, I think Iran wants to seize, to hold. They want to get rid of the Saud rule. The House of Saud has to go. And that's what pushes the Saudis toward Israel, toward the United States, sometimes, not always. Mecca and Medina, they want to hold. That's it. That's it. That's the place. Al-Azhar, I think they would be happy just to change governments in Egypt and, you know, maybe get rid of the university. I'm not sure. But Mecca and Medina, you have to hold. You have to have it.
Yeah. Fascinating, Shoshana. And, you know, you mentioned pushing the Saudis closer to the Israelis. Point one, the Saudis have, you know, been quite public in terms of a new alliance or, shall we say, modus vivendi with China and even with Iran itself as kind of an alternative to their important relationship with the United States historically. We're hearing the Biden administration boasting that they are facilitating some new rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Walk us through what's the actual truth of the matter at the moment. Where are the Saudis? Where are their, policies leading, as you see it?
So the Saudis don't want a war. The Chinese don't want a war either. So it's helpful sometimes to engage the Chinese, or at least the Saudis think so, to lower the tension with Iran. The last thing Saudi Arabia wants is a war. The last thing China wants is war. China needs oil. So that accounts for that. The Saudis are not happy with the United States for good reason, for fair reason. The president has not treated them well. So they also look at Israel and they say, what can we do? How can we work together? Can we work together? And the answer is probably yes. But the more the United States creates conditions that make it hard for Saudi Arabia and for Israel, the less likely that is. Inserting the Palestinians in here was a big mistake. Do you want to know why?
This really raises the question. I do answer that in response to this question. Last question, if you could. Why does the United States need to have a role in this at all? It seemed as though the Saudis and the Israelis were doing a rather good job of trying to fashion some kind of new Abraham Accord, if you wish, or something akin to it by themselves, and that the United States is, as usual, being unhelpful under the Biden administration.
Okay, so the Biden administration looked at the Trump administration and said, Abraham Accords, oh, that was actually a good thing. We won't admit it, but it was a good thing. We need to have something to run on. You cannot run on the disgusting withdrawal from Afghanistan. You cannot run on the economy. You cannot run on energy prices. So what are you going to run on? Let's make a deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia. We'll run on that. That's where they are. The Saudis, by the way, did a very clever thing. They were told they had to make an overture to the Palestinians. They offered them a consulate in Jerusalem. They offered them Saudi representation in a consulate in Jerusalem, knowing perfectly well that such a thing is impossible. That's it. That was their offer. Yes, the Saudis and the Israelis would do better alone.
Yeah, and that's, I hope, where we'll find them going. Shoshana Bryan, thank you. Very quick tour of a very complex part of the world, as always, but you've brought a lot of clarity to it, and we appreciate so much what you do at the Jewish Policy Center. Come back to us with updates on all of this if you would. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm always pleased to be able to say we're back with Trevor Loudon, one of my personal heroes, an enormously courageous individual, as well as one who has, I think, contributed mightily to a problem set that most of us ignore, and very few others who aren't ignoring it are willing to speak of, and certainly speak as forthrightly about, as is Trevor, and that would be the enemy within problem inside this country. Trevor hails from New Zealand originally. He is one of those foreign-born American patriots I admire so much and believe are so necessary to our understanding of the perilous state of affairs here in the United States, the extent to which we are really at risk of losing our freedoms and perhaps our republic to boot. And he has been through a variety of important platforms and products, helping expose all of that and raise the alarm, the watchman on the wall, if you will. He is the author of Enemies Within, the driving force behind a movie of the same name, and Enemies Within the Church. He is also the author of two really important multi-volume sets, one about security risk senators, the other about House Un-Americans, and he is the host and the celebrity star, I think it's fair to call it now, of a wonderful new product, the Trevor Loudon Report at livefromamerica.tv. I think you can find it on all of the podcast platforms, and we're always glad when you can find him here. Trevor Loudon, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Frank. It's good to be here.
So I have a lot of things that I want to talk to you about. We've got three blocks in which to do as much as we can. So let me begin with one that is top of mind. I've been in recent days in Texas and in New Hampshire. I know you are traveling as well. When I talk to Americans about the challenge that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party at the moment, one of the things that I have found they routinely and properly respond to with horror are reports that we now have, by some estimates, 10,000 or more young, fit, military-age, unaccompanied Chinese men who seem to be traveling with similar kits and in groups coming across our southern border. The prospect, according to our friend Michael Yan, who, as you know, is a distinguished special operator veteran as well as combat correspondent, is that those men are Chinese People's Liberation Army personnel coming here to, well, do incalculable harm, perhaps, to our country in the event that a shooting war with China begins. As a specialist in the problem of enemies within, would you credit those reports as possible? And if so, how would you assess the prospect of real problems arising from their arrival here?
Well, I think it's absolutely credible. Look, we know that Hezbollah and Hamas have been sending operatives across the southern border for many years. We have credible reports of Russian Spetsnaz coming across the border at certain times. But these are reports, credible reports from Michael Yan and others of Chinese operatives coming through the Darien Gap into Mexico, from Panama into Mexico. And there are indications on some of their behavior, some of the rituals they're undergoing, like the celebrated cutting of chickens' throats and drinking the blood that's been reported, which is a hallmark of Chinese special forces. But you look at it logically, you've got a wide open open border, which has been given to us by the Marxists in our government. The Chinese are preparing for war against the United States. Why wouldn't they use the opportunity to bring thousands of operatives across the border so when hostilities start, they can blow up bridges, they can poison reservoirs, commit assassinations, maybe release biological weapons, even nukes. Who knows what they're carrying across the border? If you were the Chinese government, given the porous southern border, given their already deep relationship with Mexico, wouldn't you be doing the same thing? Doesn't it make complete sense?
It does. What doesn't make sense, Trevor, of course, is that we're allowing this to happen, that we're witnessing. It's not just Michael Yan, as you say, there are others. There are clearly, I'm sure, border personnel who are observing this as well. They're not only not stopping them, they're not interrogating them, they're not arresting them. Instead, they're doing what they're doing with all these other illegal immigrants. They're giving them taxpayer subsidized transit to whatever point around the country they wish to go to. I mean, again, what could possibly go wrong here? And the fact that, as you say, this is a direct result of deliberate policies of our government. You say they're Marxists in our government. Joe Biden is certainly leading the charge here with his personal involvement in opening the border, executive orders and the like. Does this not constitute further proof, Trevor, that we are in the hands of enemies of this country when you look at the policies of the government of the United States?
Well, I believe it is. And the Center for the Center for Security Policy, the Committee for the Present Danger China have been pointing out for some time that there is a very deep Chinese pro-Chinese bias in the current administration that's reflected in several cabinet, officers and the president himself. It's no secret that his family is under investigation for deep compromise by the Chinese. I saw a BBC report the other day saying in 2001 that Joe Biden had offered his services to the Chinese government to negotiate trade deals with the United States. So this is nothing new. You've got Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, saying that we're going to have all our military vehicles electric by 2030. Well, you could say that's political correct stupidity, or you could also call it sabotage. Because imagine the resources are going to be diverted into that impossible project and trying to negotiate with the Chinese to get time out on the battlefield when your batteries run low.
Yeah, to say nothing of requiring their help in putting the batteries into the electric vehicles, for heaven's sake.
Which China is the major supplier of electric vehicles.
You just can't
make
this
batteries.
Stuff up.
So look, Occam's razor. What's the most simple explanation here? The simple explanation is the US government is subject to elite capture that goes right to the president, many of the cabinet officials, many of the our intelligence officials, security officials, and justice officials have clearly been captured or compromised by the Chinese. There's no other logical explanation why this situation could be allowed to continue.
Yes. I fear you're right. The Occam's razor applies here. The most obvious explanation fitting the facts. But to just drill down a little bit further, you're very kind to compliment the work of our Center for Security Policy and the Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you are a very important member, Trevor. But I want to just salute you in turn. I mean, your work on, among other things, the Accountability Initiative, which has 23 different dossiers, as I recall, on members of the Biden administration, as well as some members of Congress, to say nothing of your various other books and essays and interviews and all the rest, is a body of work upon which everybody should be drawing at the moment. But Trevor, and I want to come back after a short break with a little bit further detail on a couple of these cabinet officers, because it's just chilling, really, what's going on here. But for the moment, what, based on your study of the Chinese Communist Party, is the likely takeaway for them of all of this? I mean, you've made the point that they're going to exploit it, but does that translate, in your estimation, to them thinking that they can actually act, if not without cost or with impunity, at least unacceptable costs, to take us down using shooting war techniques, including those here on the home front, if possible?
Look, Mao said many years ago, if China lost a quarter of its population but achieved world socialism, it would be worth the cost. You know, we know that from the leaked broadcast about a year ago that the Chinese were preparing war then, and they thought their coastal cities would be devastated by American attacks, but they were quite willing to accept that cost. You know, life is very cheap if you're a communist, if you've got a massive surplus of young men you want to get rid of. And that's something we have to think about. Because of the one-child policy that was in operation in China for many years, approximately 30 million baby girls were aborted, meaning 30 million young Chinese men don't have a partner. That's a big social issue. So they can afford to lose. They can afford to lose a lot of young men if they can take down America. And they lose 20, 30 million people in the process. I think they'll think that is a good deal.
Those are high costs. And if they think they're even less than that, I think you're right. They're even more inclined. Trevor Ladin is in the house. He will be with us for another two blocks. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more right after this. Thank you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. You don't have to embrace conspiracy theories about how a lot of Maui just burned up to feel uneasy about plans the state government of Hawaii had for the island before the fire. A Hawaii Digital Government Summit, scheduled for next month in Maui, suggests Governor Josh Green and his subordinates envision it becoming a smart island. The word smart these days actually means control. Smart meters, smart appliances, smart cities, and most especially, smart medical cards, vaccine passports, and other IDs are means of turning over data and ultimately decisions about your life to somebody else. Inevitably, that will mean the government. If fundamentally transforming a tropical paradise into a digital gulag repels you, brace for what the smart people behind giving the World Health Organization dictatorial powers have in mind for all of us. Learn more at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Trevor Loudon, one of the country's, well, national treasures, as far as I'm concerned, imported, yes, from down under New Zealand, but a man who nonetheless loves our country and understands better than the vast majority of us how precious is the freedom that we take for granted, most of us, and how perishable it might prove to be, especially at the hands of enemies within, captured elites of the Chinese Communist Party among them. And Trevor, you mentioned earlier the problem of Marxists within our government, the cabinet of the United States. You've documented at accountabilityinitiative.org, in particular, a woman who has extraordinary power, though it's not often recognized as such. It's the Secretary of Interior. Her name is Deborah Holland. Tell us about her, if you would, quickly.
Well, we saw her just the other day with President Biden signing an order shutting off a whole bunch of Colorado to uranium mining. You know, they're going to make it a national park. You know, this is one of our key uranium mining areas. The first thing, going back, the first thing Joe Biden did when he canceled the when he came to office was cancel the Keystone Pipeline, because Native Americans were protesting in the Dakotas. Those protests were organized by Judith LeBlanc of the Communist Party USA Central Committee. The Communist Party USA is loyal both to Communist China and Putin's Russia. So after that, Judith LeBlanc mounted a campaign to promote her very good friend, a Native American congresswoman from New Mexico named Deb Haaland, as U.S. Secretary of the Interior. This is easily verifiable on the internet. There's multiple pictures of them campaigning together, dining together, etc. Judith LeBlanc of the Communist Party USA mounted a campaign because nobody knew who Deb Haaland was. She had buses, she had badges, Deb for Interior. They got all these celebrity endorsements, Alyssa Milano, Sarah Silverman, Mark Ruffalo, Hanoi Jane Fonda, Gloria Steinem, Cher. And they mounted this campaign. They made Deb Haaland into the natural nominee. Biden nominated her for Secretary of the Interior. Four Republican senators confirmed her: Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, the usual suspects. This woman is a Marxist. I've got pictures of her holding signs for the Party of Socialism and Liberation. That's a militant communist party that supports North Korea, Cuba, and China and Iran. She is now in position overseeing 20% of America, all of the energy extraction on public lands, uranium mining, border areas, most of Alaska, and she is shutting down every single energy lease she possibly can. Right when Biden has depleted the U.S. strategic oil reserve by 50%, which is our war fighting reserve, some of it sold to China, right when he has cut our energy reserves to dangerous levels, she is shutting down every attempt to extract new energy from public lands in America. If she was directly controlled by Putin and Xi, what would she be doing differently than she is today, given the world situation we're in?
Trevor, let me turn to another very problematic individual who is currently running, as I understand it, the Labor Department. Talk about this gal, Julie Hsu, and her background.
Well, Julie Hsu is the acting Secretary of Labor. Biden tried to get her nominated when Marty Walsh, the previous Secretary of Labor, resigned.
A man with certain affinities, to the Chinese Communist Party.
Deeply connected to the Chinese Communist Party. This is
used to raise the Chinese Communist flag over mayor's office in Boston, as I recall.
Big contact of the Chinese Progressive Association, the Chinese Front in Boston. Also been to climate change conferences in China. He was China's man. But see, this is the thing. If China has somebody in the cabinet and they leave, the next person will be the same. This is Lenin. It is not the gaining of power that's important. It is the keeping of power that's important. So Julie Hsu is the acting secretary. Biden can't get it confirmed, so he's just leaving her in place as acting secretary without actually going through continuing to pursue the confirmation process. Even the usual rhino Republicans won't confirm this woman. Julie Hsu at Stanford University was involved with an Asia-Pacific radical group that was directly affiliated to the League of Revolutionary Struggle, the main pro-Chinese communist group at the time. She left there, became involved in the so-called sweatshop movement, United Students Against Sweatshops, which is a Maoist front. Then she worked with Asian Americans Advancing Justice, which is run by Stuart Kuo, a longtime supporter of the Communist Workers' Party. Now, the Communist Workers' Party was the Antifa of the 80s. They invaded the Democratic Party convention. They promoted shooting cops. They were militant. They used axe handles and guns against their opposition. They morphed in the 1980s to the New Democratic Movement and moved into the Democratic Party. Judy Chu, the congresswoman from California, was part of this crowd. And Margaret Chin, the former New York City councilwoman, was also part of this crowd. But Judy Hsu is heavily involved with Stuart Kuo. Stuart Kuo is also a leader of the Committee of 100, which is Communist China's main lobby group in this country. Julie Hsu is also close personal friends with another former leader of the Communist Workers' Party called Kent Wong. Now, he is a big unionist in California who has built huge ties between the California Teachers Union and Chinese unions. And all of these groups have come together to promote Julie Hsu into this position.
And she occupies it effectively,
even
though she's not been confirmed by the United States Senate. Yeah. This is the Labor Department of the United States, an instrument that can be used, let's be clear, to marshal organized labor for radical leftist purposes, advantaging the Chinese Communist Party. Trevor, we have to take a very short break. We'll come back. We'll just finish your thought, and then we'll pivot to another important topic. The Pentagon, right after this. We're back, and we're speaking with Trevor Louden, author of The Enemies Within, one of the great authorities on the subject, and we've been talking about enemies within the government of the United States, specifically at the cabinet level. And Julie Hsu, the acting Secretary of Labor, is a person that you were just giving us a bit of background on, Trevor. And finish your thought about what she's doing and capable of doing in that position.
where she's completely in bed with militant pro-Chinese operatives. Now, recently, there was almost a strike in America. The UPS, the Teamsters Union, had a threatened to strike against UPS, 320,000 members in this union. And they basically told Biden to butt out and the Labor Department to butt out. The Labor Department supported the Teamsters. The Teamsters are now controlled by a pro-Chinese communist organization called the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. They are the people who burnt most of America after the George Floyd riots. A Chinese Communist Party controls the Teamsters. They were hell-bent on the strike. They were going to bring the economy down. That was part of their revolutionary process. And if the UPS hadn't buckled at the last moment, we would have seen the biggest strike in 100 years. Julie Su, the pro-Chinese, was in the Labor Department, and this union is controlled by pro-Chinese communists. Could you imagine the scenario? And now the UPS is buckled. They're going to go after Amazon and FedEx.
Yeah. Well, and I suspect the economy of the United States more generally, it serves their purposes for sure.
Well, they believe if they can start a big strike, that will guarantee America slides into recession right when we're facing war with China.
Yeah. They may have another biological attack in their sleeve as well, but
I'm sure they do.
They'll accomplish this one way or the other, I'm pretty sure. Especially, as we said at the beginning, if they've got other options on the home front, including military ones, this is potentially
a very
fraught moment. Trevor, against this backdrop, one of the things that is particularly worrying to me is that the cultural Marxists' march through the institutions has now laid siege. Well, that's not quite accurate. They're inside the walls of the last institution standing, arguably, that would be the United States military. And I'm very concerned that cultural Marxist nostrums and policies like critical race theory and the whole transgender agenda and diversity, equity, inclusion, and climate change and you know, all of the various sexual stuff, is being used to help fracture and undermine our armed forces. And a man who has apparently embraced these, he certainly extols them at every turn, General C.Q. Brown, the current Chief of Staff of the Air Force, now the nominee to become the next Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it would seem to me, a deeply problematic appointment as well. Your thoughts, sir?
Look, you know, he's been through the War College. They all have. And we got to understand that the War College now is not much different from any woke university in the country. They have Marxists on the faculty. These young guys who are coming out of West Point and whatever, going through the War College. Well, even at West Point, they're getting indoctrinated.
Sure. You know, the Air Force Academy, most especially, under this guy's watch.
All of these organizations, the Coast Guard, all of the training organizations are influenced by Marxists now. You know, we saw Matthew Lohmeyer, very prominent member of the Space Force, was kicked out because he exposed the Marxism in the Space Force.
Yeah. More generally.
Yeah, the military more general, the wokeness. You know, wokeism is Marxism. Wokeism means consciousness raising. That's what we used to call communist brainwashing. Now they call it wokeism. And so this man is imbued with wokeism. He's risen through the ranks. And what we see as in the FBI and other organizations, it is the administrators that are rising to the top, rather than the combat fighters. Mm-hmm. And these warriors. Administrators are particularly prone to the wokest agenda.
So now, this is, this in is fairness, a this guy was a combat pilot earlier in his career. But sure. What you talk about in terms of the promotion, Trevor, and you've studied this very closely, you understand that the what I call Obama-Biden administration's three terms have made a focused effort on promoting their people. And that includes military officers. They've purged. I had a senior civilian in one of the services tell me the other day that he had just been at a meeting with four-star generals in which he said they have fired all of the smart generals.
Mm.
And it's not that they were smart necessarily. They were smart probably, but certainly they were patriots.
Yeah.
They were warriors. And what we've got left, whether they're administrators or whether they're imbued with this Marxist ideology for some reason, or whether they've simply gone along to get along, because that's what is being driven now by the civilians. The United States Senate, you know, they may be taking a pass on approving Julie Sue, but they're poised to approve this very, very, I think, unqualified and certainly undesirable man to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We've encouraged all of our listeners to go to rejectgeneralbrown.org to let their senators know that they do not want this man confirmed. And just a concluding 30 seconds on this, Trevor, how dangerous would it be against the backdrop of everything else you've talked about if the United States military is really in the thrall of this Marxist crap as well?
Look, our enemies right now, which include Russia and China and Iran, are all looking at America and America's resolve. And when you see some woke general or some weak general promoted to the highest levels, that has got to embolden our enemies. You know, you got to have generals who carry big sticks and are willing to stand up.
Amen. Trevor Loudon, God bless you, my friend. Thank you for your great leadership on all of these fronts. Come back to us with updates, if you would, very soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.